In the basement of Diane's grandfather's house, there are many old tools. I would call them antiques, but that might convey the sense that they are not used. Nothing could be further from the truth. Erwin has a tool for just about any manual task you could imagine, and he knows their exact uses intimately. A tool in particular has always fascinated me. It is an electric drill press from probably around the 1930s. It is the typical safety horror that we would expect of a specimen of that era. It has an exposed gear train that when operating whirs at many hundred RPM, threatening to take off a finger at any time. But with some caution, this sturdy power tool works wonderfully. In fact, it works quite a bit better than the original manufacturers could have hoped. For some time after World War II, Erwin's brother, outfitted the drill press with the transmission from a Model T Ford. The drill press now has three forward and one reverse speed. You can choose any of these with the convenient flick of a very large lever. This modification of the drill press is a perfect example of a hack. Now let's put some common misconceptions to rest. A hacker is not a teenage computer criminal intent on breaking into the computers of the Pentagon or your credit card company to steal your identity. The proper term for this sort of person is a cracker, or more simply, a crook. Nor are hackers intent on downloading thousands of songs and movies from the internet without paying. The proper term for this is piracy or theft. The term hacker goes back to a time before one could break into a computer. In the 1950s, computers were a rare and jealously protected resource. Operating a computer meant punching dozens of holes in hundreds of paper cards and then feeding them each to the computer. A single misstep in the process meant that your program was buggy or completely ruined. One then had to start from scratch. This is not a process that lends itself to stealth of any sort. It was in this era that the members of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Tech Model Railroad Club first began to use the term hacker to denote someone who took wild pleasure merely being involved in the solving of complex problems. Soon, as the first transistor-based mainframe computers came into use, coincidentally installed just downstairs from the Tech Model Railroad Club's clubhouse, the members adopted them to solve signal and control tasks on their model railway. The Tech Model Railroad Club remains to this day a mecca for hackers. Simply put, hacking is the process of applying ingenuity to practical problem solving, and most importantly, taking delight in the process. So why would I talk about a hacker ethic? Our two readings today talk about a worldview that is not familiar to most of us. In the first, Michel de Certeau admonishes us to make le perruque, or literally a wig, of our work. That is, to subvert the mechanisms of production to suit our needs, and in doing so, elevate our role above mere consumers. More on this later. In the second reading, we hear the thoughts of a 17-year-old Russian hacker. He talks of a way of viewing the world that not only makes one want to hack, but almost dictates a spirit of revolution. But again, how do we go from particular technological preoccupations to an ethical system? Hackers are people that see the world as a collection of fascinating problems that need to be solved, and because of their particular mindset, consider it their job to solve them. They don't approach this job with trepidation, but rather with relish. For whatever benefits may come from solving such problems, the most valuable thing is the knowledge they gain in the process. For a hacker's greatest pride is in their practical knowledge. Accumulation of knowledge for hackers is often seen as a sort of currency. Your net worth in the hacker community is measured in skills. And just to distinguish themselves from everybody else, hackers find it necessary to spell everything differently. So skills is S-K-I-L-Z. It is sort of technological meritocracy. This gives rise to a curious question. If knowledge is the currency of your wealth, how do you spend it? It is certainly possible to exchange knowledge for money. One can seek employment that makes use of one's talents, and many hackers do. After all, unless your field of expertise is agriculture, the fruits of one's hacking skills is seldom edible. Alternately, one can produce intellectual property, things like trade secrets or patents. This too can be very profitable. However, seeking monetary compensation for one's skills is not the highest form of enrichment that the hacker seeks. Rather, a hacker wants to exchange their knowledge and skills for more of the same. Employment in a commercial enterprise and/or the production of intellectual property necessitates a proprietary approach to knowledge. I must conceal my knowledge from others, says the corporate engineer, so that I can leverage it into a product that is not easily duplicated by my competitor. This is an abhorrent model to the hacker. Instead, the hacker wants to demonstrate their mastery. Look what I can do, says the hacker. I have created my own shortwave broadcast station using only a box of toothpicks, a razor blade, and a wad of tissue paper, and of course, my mad skills. What? You don't believe me? No problem. Here's how you can do it too. Full disclosure is the key to credibility within the hacker community. For without demonstrating the details of your process, there is no convincing your fellow hackers that you've actually accomplished what you claim. Now, the interesting thing of the transfer of knowledge is that there is no immediate compensation. The knowledge is offered simply for recognition, the hope that others might find it useful, and the anticipation that others will offer their knowledge in a similar fashion. The hacker community is a form of gift culture. The main product is know-how, and credit is accrued for giving. The community as a whole, indeed anyone who wishes to partake of the knowledge from the community, is enriched. Often one's contributions is so unique or esoteric that only a few dozen people in the world would ever find it of use. For instance, software to run your USB thumb drive on the almost now defunct DOS operating system. Sometimes hundreds of millions of people will find your contribution wildly useful. The Linux GNU operating system running most of the web's servers today is a product of hacker culture. Hackers gain in reputation based both on the popularity and usefulness of their work. Because hackers like to think of their culture as a meritocracy, and as they have a perhaps overdeveloped sense of value of their own intellectual endeavors, duplication of effort is considered an almost absolute evil. Eric S. Raymond, venerable and eclectic proto-hacker, once wrote, "No problem should ever have to be solved twice." His point is not that you shouldn't feel free to reinvent the wheel. But if you figure out how to build a wheel, you owe it to the rest of us to publish your work. That way, the rest of us can get on with building unicycles, bicycles, tricycles, and Segway human transporters. This raises the human need to share knowledge to an imperative. In 1984, Stuart Brand, famous editor of the Whole Earth Catalog, a quintessential handbook for hackers of all stripes in the 1970s and 80s, famously said, "Information wants to be expensive. That is to say, that it is hard-won and valuable." This seems self-evident to us. But Brand continues, "Information also wants to be free." There have been countless riffs on this quote over the years. The English language makes this contention ambiguous. There is free, as in free beer. There is also free, as in free speech. But this is an ambiguity that Brand is comfortable with. Information wants to be cheap. Disseminating information is becoming very inexpensive. It is worth noting that Brand actually relayed this quote in a time before the World Wide Web. Also, information wants its liberty. The nature of communications is asymmetrical, weighted towards wider dissemination. It is very hard to take back a piece of information once you have shared it with somebody else. And once they share it with somebody else, the task becomes even more harder, geometrically so if it's disseminated widely enough. The great enabler of the hacker knowledge economy has, of course, been the internet. The World Wide Web, and before the web, Usenet and Gopher vastly accelerated the development of hacker culture. These forums also favored a particular type of hacker, the computer hacker. This is something that isn't so true now as people's use of the web has broadened to every walk of life. Remember, a hacker is one who delights in solving practical problems. Programmers are not the only hackers. Mechanics, chemists, lawyers, carpenters, linguists, artists of all types. Anyone who approaches the world with the right mindset is a hacker. We have talked about the common elements of hacker culture, but my talk today is titled The Hacker Ethic. When do a list of traits constitute an ethic? When a community shares a set of common practices or values, these are not in themselves an ethic. But among many hackers, these common values are not just shared traits. They are values that they have sought to cultivate and exploit towards specific ends. The last 10 years has seen the rise of a movement called hacktivism. These are hackers that band together around specific social or political causes to solve a problem. Examples of this are people that have created software to circumvent political censorship in China, or the 17-person team at MIT who have designed and now are distributing millions of $175 laptops to children in Nigeria, Libya, and Brazil. These efforts are undertaken openly, fully documented, and shared for the fair use of all. Ultimately, the hope is that others will come along and build on the existing efforts. Hackers also seek to provide imaginative solutions to other serious challenges. Rural solar-powered lighting for students in Tibet so that they might study after sundown. Flood warning systems in Central America. Solar ovens to replace cancer-causing wood-burning stoves. And evaporative refrigeration that consumes nothing more than a few cups of water each day. Both of these last examples from sub-Saharan Africa. I think there are important values that we might borrow from this culture. Our world is a place of increasing inequity. More and more information is commodified. As we have discussed earlier, commodification of information is antithetical to the hacker way. By freeing information, and dare I say knowledge, some of this inequity may be addressed, but not in the sense of charity. I just spoke of a $175 laptop that's being distributed throughout the world. One of the striking features of this laptop is that It is loaded with all the tools you need to modify its software and to write your own software to run on it. There is no portion of the laptop that is not freely modifiable by the end user. This was the intention of the creators. The machine truly becomes the property of the end user. The hope is not only that the laptop more fully serves its owner, but that the owner redefines the laptop in a way that the original designers couldn't even dream of. Our culture, or more precisely, corporate media, and those that have vested interests in consumer retail, try to deliver to us a finished product. It is not meant that we should engage in any creative process with these products or alter them in any way. Rather, we should consume them, and having done so, replace them, or at least show up at the Cineplex or tune in next week for the next installment. They produce, we consume. The perfect commercial dialect. No, wait a second. A dialect implies a reciprocal interaction. This model has serious implications not only for our physical resources, but for our imagination and our souls. Let me go back to Michel de Certeau. In his book, The Practice of Everyday Life, he talks about this unidirectional flow of consumption and says that we have never and will never openly rebel against it. Rather, he points to the concept of bricolage, or roughly translated, the French phrase for do it yourself. The consumer repurposes the consumable and reinterprets it in a way that the producer never intended. This is at the very heart of the hacker ethic, a subversion of the centralized cultural authority, recycling its products to suit one's own needs. One example that he gives is the practitioners of Santeria used the colonizers and the slave masters' Christian saints to disguise their African deities so that they could continue with their own worship. A far more mundane example that we might see today might be how some people use Google's mail service as a web-based file storage system, or use Google's mail system as a superior spam filter to work on their own email system. Neither application is condoned by Google, but both are widely used and cannot be prevented without Google crippling their own service. We should not overreach. Technology is by no means our savior. Meritocracies often trample the needs of the under-resourced. Gift cultures sometimes come into direct conflict with the traditional economies that surround them. Open sharing of ideas is often intentionally conflated with the theft of intellectual properties, by those with vested interests. Establishment acceptance of hackers and their work often leads to the conversion of free information into proprietary trade secrets to be bought and sold. However, in an over-commercialized world of constrained resources, the delight and innovative problem-solving, openness, and emphasis on sharing of our abilities and knowledge are traits that we might well emulate.